You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
This is Deanna Spangola, and I'm broadcasting, as always, from the Chicago suburbs, where it's sunny and nice. It's a wonderful day. I appreciate you joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org. I invite you to also visit and subscribe to SpangolaSpeaks.net, and I invite you to visit ScreeningSandyHook.net. And during the program, email questions or comments to comments at spingola.email. Visit our chat room, and that you can find that at spingola.chatango.com. You can view our guest lineup from the past and those from the future. And anyway, we've got a lot going on. I'm multitasking here, reading what. Okay, I guess we're having trouble getting our first guest. Okay, we're getting it. Oh gosh. Well, I usually send my guest on Thursday. I send my guest a reminder that they're going to be on the program, and I give them all the details and all of that. But our first guest today is Dylan Howard, and he is the author of Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Tales. And of course, that is just an amazing situation, an amazing book. I've read the book. And of course, Epstein's been in the news, and all of his shenanigans have been in the news. It's been of interest to a lot of people. I guess we don't have a guest then? Okay, let's see. I wonder if I have another way of getting a hold of him. Let me just check and see if I have a backup. Let me see. Backup. I do have a backup. Let me give you this other phone number here. I'll put it in the window. Sometimes this happens. Okay, so we'll try the other phone number to see if we can't get a hold of him. The book is very interesting. As soon as it came out, I purchased it. I think that a lot of people are, they were curious, of course, when they found out that Epstein had been arrested, and then with the recent arrest of his co-partner in crime, and apparently she's in jail and awaiting trial, which is very interesting. Let's see. Back up. You didn't see it in the window? Okay, hang on. Let me just... Okay, hang on. Yeah. No, not yet. Oh, my gosh. Because I see your message, got message calling Dylan. Then I gave you the phone number, the backup phone number twice. Oh my gosh, okay, let's see if we can ship it to you another way. I don't know. How else am I supposed to give it to you if you can't see it? Cause I'm sending it to your RBN. Huh? Oh, okay, yeah, sometimes it helps just to reboot or whatever, but Anyway, we do have a backup number for him, and hopefully we can get him on the program because he's got a lot of interesting things to say about Epstein. Okay, great, we have him. Thank goodness. So, we are going to have our guest momentarily. And as I mentioned, he's got a lot of things to say about Epstein. He is the author of Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Tales. And it's quite a read. If you haven't purchased the book, then I suggest that you do so because it's... Oh, okay, great. Dylan, are you with us? Dylan?
Hello, Dylan?
Yes, Dylan? Dylan, are you with us? Okay. So what's going on here? So maybe try him again? Or?
No, it's Dylan Howard speaking here.
Okay, Dylan, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, we're very happy to have you on the program today to talk about your book. I've read it several times, and the name of your book is Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Tales, and it's quite a read. It really is. And you mentioned so many names in the book. So where do you want to start out as far as how did you happen to decide to write the book?
Well, I had been covering Epstein for a number of years in my past roles as editors of various publications. And I would consider that I had so much research that as soon as the story of his arrest at Teterboro Airport, it became quite obvious that I was well-suited and in a position to be able to write the definitive account of what took place leading up to his arrest. And then when his suicide took place, it only emphasized things even more dramatically, and that a book had to be written about what is the real story of Jeffrey Epstein, which is vastly different than what the mainstream media has said.
Okay, and in what ways would you say that it's different?
Well, the reality is that, save for a few mainstream organizations, they have completely turned a blind eye to the reality of who Jeffrey Epstein was. Not only was he a complex, damaged, and controlling individual, but he was also incredibly calculating and predatory. He reveled in his status as a globe-trotting pedophile, but he used his power to exploit the vulnerable and underage for purpose. It wasn't just his own sexual peccadilloes. He used his access to trap the rich and famous, and then he traded in that dirt that he accumulated on them to the world's most secretive intelligence agency. Epstein was a spy running a complex intelligence operation for the purpose of blackmailing powerful individuals and politicians in the United States and abroad.
And the names of the people that were involved in the records is just rather amazing. And apparently just recently, several names were released. But you also give his background. He was a genius as far as figures, and he worked on Wall Street, and he became friends with Wexner, and that's how he got his townhouse, his big mansion in Manhattan. And he just had so many, convoluted relationships. And as you say, he was a manipulator and a predator. And he could have been arrested for some of the things that he was doing when he was working on Wall Street.
Absolutely. I mean, he was disposed of at a I think it was Bear Stearns at one place or Goldman Sachs for alleged insider trading, ended up being connected to Towers Financial, which prior to Bernie Madoff was the largest Ponzi scheme in US history. You make a very valid point tying him to Leslie Wexner. Wexner, of course, owns Victoria's Secret, and that allowed him to get access to these individuals, by which he would say, you are auditioning for a role as a Victoria's Secret model. The names tied to him include Prince Andrew, Presidents Bill Clinton and Donald Trump, billionaire hedge funder Gleb Jubin, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, Larry Summers, the ex-Harvard president, former New York Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, former Maine Senator George Mitchell, Leslie Wexner, as we mentioned, and many others whose names figure in Epstein's, quote, little black book of contacts. Now, it's critical to note all of these men have denied any wrongdoing with regards to their involvement with Epstein. But that's how he built up a power base. That's how he built up the Rolodex that would introduce him to the potential next target that he would use and abuse for the benefit of the Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell blackmail sex trafficking network that was essentially a spy intelligence operation.
Now, do you think that he worked for the Mossad?
Absolutely, 100%, no doubt. And this is not just my say-so. This is the say-so of Ari Ben-Mashani, who has said that he provided intelligence to the Israeli military by virtue of that. The connection between the Israeli military and Mossad is very significant. Jeffrey Epstein's connections into Israel generated or began as a result of his introduction to Ghislaine Maxwell. Ghislaine Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell, the media tycoon who owned the Mirror newspaper group in London, and then also the New York Daily News, was found dead off the back of his yacht, Lady Ghislaine, I think in the late 1980s or early 1990s, believed to be assassinated by Mossad because he had embezzled hundreds of millions of dollars in pension funds from his employees and was essentially a liability. Now, before that, Ari Ben-Mashani, who was the spy handler for Robert Maxwell, recalls an incident in which Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine met with Jeffrey Epstein, and they turned the business of spying over to Maxwell and Epstein. They were the heir apparent in this. Let's also not forget that Jeffrey Epstein has admitted that he was effectively a bounty hunter and arms trader for Adnan Khashoggi, the notorious Saudi Arabian.
Yeah, he was doing all sorts of things.
Yeah, his connections to Saudi Arabia are strong, and I also believe that he had connections to Russia. This was not a complicated intelligence ring. He would collect compromat on high-powered individuals and sell it to the highest bidder. Those people would then use it as leverage to flip these people into sources. And for a foreign government, having sources inside the United States, the most powerful country in the world, was an invaluable tool.
Wow. Now you mentioned Trump in the book several times. I think there's something like 67 mentions of his name. Trump has attempted to distance himself from Epstein. But yet they were pretty good friends from 1987 after Trump's divorce from Ivana Trump. You mentioned that he says he's very good friends with him, and that they partied together and that they were pals. And then, of course, later on, Trump said, and I quote, "I'm no fan." I don't know. So can you address that?
Look, President Trump, like President Clinton, has sought to minimize his connection to Jeffrey Epstein. In President Trump's case, not Ghislaine Maxwell, by virtue of the fact that he has said that he wishes her well. But the reality here is that Trump has not lied, but has ignored purposefully how deep the connections run between he, Maxwell, that's Robert Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell, and Jeffrey Epstein. In the late 1980s, Jeffrey Epstein introduced President Trump to Adnan Khashoggi. Adnan Khashoggi at the time was selling his yacht. Donald Trump, who was not necessarily a boater, decided that he was going to buy Adnan Khashoggi's boat, and he renamed it Lady Ivanka. Robert Maxwell's boat was Lady Ghislaine. So the connection between Trump, Epstein, and Maxwell goes back to at least 1989, according to my research.
Right.
He purchased that boat for $30 million. So Trump's version of events is that he really only knew Epstein from the time of Mar-a-Lago in the early 2000s. Well, the reality is, 2 decades earlier, the four of them were in cahoots on the sale of a yacht. Now, that doesn't mean that Trump's guilty of anything,
right,
any impropriety, but it certainly does appear on the surface to be not a full and informed annotation of his relationship with Maxwell and with Jeffrey Epstein.
Right, and you mentioned at the beginning of the book that Trump said that he had known him, what exactly did he say? Their relationship goes back to 1987, and let's see, it's right on the title page, just inside the title page. It's very interesting. Yes, you said.
I think everybody has been quick to want to minimize their involvement with with Jeffrey Epstein, and understandably so. But what
sure.
is curious is the statement of Trump wishing Ghislaine Maxwell well. This is a woman who is accused of probably the most heinous sex trafficking ring the world has ever seen.
Oh.
A 6-count indictment that actually implicates her in the pedophilia, not just that she sought or set up the pedophilia for Jeffrey Epstein, but she actually took place in it. That's what makes the 6-count indictment so interesting and so tragic, to think that the lives of these innocent victims was taken from them through the depraved actions of these two individuals. And I actually know one of the individuals named in the 6-count indictment, who is referred to as a Jane Doe. And I personally have first-hand knowledge of what she went through. And it's disgusting. So to hear the President of the United States say that he wishes someone who is charged and, with respect, is up the proverbial creek without a paddle, such is her guilt, is unbecoming of the person that sits in the Oval Office.
Yes, I agree with you. Yes. That is pretty disgusting.
Really. Now, he's justifying that by saying he wishes anyone inside a correctional facility the best.
Oh,
you know what? Joe Schmo in Boise, Idaho, is not getting the same platitudes that the president is offering Ghislaine Maxwell. There are two tiers of justice in this country. I've long been a proponent of the theory, and it's quite clear that Ghislaine Maxwell is being set up for the higher end of those two tiers, just like Roger Stone, just like Michael Flynn, just like others that benefited from the proximity of Donald Trump for their lives.
Right. You also in your book talk about, and I don't want to go away from what we're talking about now, but just the idea that that Donald Barr and his son William Barr are now associated. Well, William Barr is associated now with Donald Trump, which is very interesting.
I mean, the tentacles and the way in which these tentacles are attached to so many individuals is quite illuminating, to say the least. I think that's the adjective that should be used to describe it. William Barr's father hired Jeffrey Epstein as a teacher at the Dalton School in New York City. He was ultimately fired from that job. So his connection to the Attorney General and the Attorney General's family go back very deeply. And it's hard to ignore those connections when you're considering this particular case. Now, William Barr was certainly very vocal about the death of Epstein. He's been vocal about Ghislaine Maxwell. But it's just all too curious, these connections, and I don't want to cast aspersions on people, but it's a very tangled web.
Indeed. And Donald Barr also wrote a story, a play or something, about a sex slave at about the same time that he met Epstein.
I mean, you can't make these things up. Barr wrote, he was obsessed with sci-fi, and he wrote a book about child sex slavery. In fact, it's still available. It's called Space Relation. And it is a novel. It's almost too hard to describe the contents of the book. It talks about sex trafficking and the such, and it just seems all too connected. The book is unsettling. It depicts the rape of enslaved people, particularly teenage girls, and other coercive sex acts for the purposes of entertainment. And it just seems all too, again, I don't want to cast dispersions, but, you know, in what world do you have, say, for example, Deanna, if you and I were connected and I'm convicted of a sexual crime, and it turns out that a family member of mine wrote about a sexual crime that I ultimately would be convicted of. You can't make this up.
Right. Yeah, it's just all too well connected. And you've documented it. This is something that has been documented. The other name, too, that I thought was very interesting was Alex Acosta, who was a U.S. attorney in Miami, who was also, you have to wonder, okay, now Epstein was convicted in 2008 for sexual improprieties, and he spent, what, 5 months in jail? Or some ridiculous?
Absolutely, yes. You were actually breaking up there. Would you mind repeating the question?
Oh, Epstein was arrested in 2008.
Yes. You were breaking up there, and I just wanted to get the totality of the question.
Right.
So Epstein was arrested in Palm Beach, Florida. And Alex Acosta, in my view, is not a villain in this scenario. He has openly said He ultimately lost his job as Trump's Labor Secretary because he was the U.S. District U.S. Attorney, I should say, that prosecuted Epstein and gave him the sweetheart plea deal of the century. But in Acosta's defense, he has said that he was told that this was above his pay grade, quote unquote. So one has to give that consideration. Who told him that this was above his pay grade? Why did they tell him that this was above his pay grade and to go easy on Epstein? Here we have a scenario where the judicial branch of the US government, which is supposed to be independent, is being told by presumably political power or indeed other law enforcement organizations like the FBI or the CIA or other intelligence operations to take their hands off Jeffrey Epstein. Now, Acosta had to resign because of the scandal, but he was a victim of only doing what he was told. So the question remains now, and it's a very valid question, and one which the United States of America ought to know, the people of the United States of America ought to know, the question being, who in the government knew that Epstein and Maxwell were spies? When did they know? To what extent? How did they know? And why did they allow them to operate on American soil without impunity, knowing full well that they were running a sex trafficking operation that was taking the innocence of the lives of hundreds of young women whose whole fiber has been completely destroyed by this sexual trafficking ring? That is a question to me that is almost the most vital question, save for the country's reaction to COVID-19, that ought to be asked right now. But the mainstream media won't do it.
Yes, that is very interesting.
Now, why does the mainstream media not do it? Because we're living in an environment right now where the White House in itself has polarized the media. Trust in the media is at a record low, and the landscape of the media is becoming more and more polarized. When I grew up as an aspiring journalist, I knew that the goal of the activity of journalism was to provide nonpartisan reporting. We would bring either readers, listeners, viewers, accurate information, and they would deduce their own opinions from these topics. Instead, I can't fathom how the media is operating as an agenda-driven, weaponized practice. There is a bias that is destroying the truth. Both the right and left are weaponized. Much of that has been driven by the White House itself and a divisive president. But the reality here is that journalists are seemingly not journalists, they're activists, right? And
right.
They have lost their bipartisanship in an effort, if you're on the left, to ensure that Trump is not reelected, or if you're on the right, to ensure that Trump is reelected. So we have a broken, distorted state of the media industry that doesn't find the Epstein story sexy. Why does it not find it sexy? Because it implicates both sides of the political aisle.
Oh, right.
You can't blame
yes.
it on one ideological line.
Yes. Wow. So, literally, what you're implying here is the Epstein situation. Oh, we do have to take a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back.
It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes.
Our guest, our first guest today is Dylan Howard. He is the author of Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Tales. It's a wonderful read. It's it's kind of a heartbreaking read when you learn about these children. And we're not talking about a couple of children. We're talking about dozens of children. We're talking about children. Children who were innocent and were victimized by this criminal. I can't think of he's just a terrible person. He is.
Not just him. He's lame too.
Yes, both of them. Both of them are just pieces of garbage. It's the best I can do on radio. We do have, you know, FCC limitations. Now Epstein was arrested before, and if they had really done to him what needed to be done, he wouldn't have continued to do what he was doing. And this is back in 2007, when he was given this plea deal where he could plead guilty to charges of procuring a person under 18 for prostitution, and that any potential co-conspirators, which obviously Ghislaine Maxwell was already a co-conspirator, would be immune, and that he would agree to register as a sex offender. But what does that do? It just means, let's see, he was sentenced supposedly for 21.5 months, but instead then he got to serve 12 months and with 10 months of probation. And it just kept getting easier and easier to the point that they just slapped his hands, and that was about it.
Well, after Epstein's arrest on the tarmac of Teterboro Airport in July last year, he believed that he would be able to avoid the prosecution because he believed that the Southern District of New York had no legal basis to invalidate his non-prosecution agreement that he'd struck with Alex Acosta. He believed that and continued to believe that up until his death. Now, Ghislaine Maxwell also believed that agreement afforded her the protection because the wording of the 2007 agreement included non-prosecution provisions for Epstein himself and quote-unquote others, i.e. alleged co-conspirators. That agreement now didn't name any individual, but it led many to suspect that the deal covered up the larger sex trafficking operation, which of course would have been in the government's best interest, because who would want the details that the government allowed a sex trafficking ring to operate on American soil without impunity. So in the months before her arrest, Ghislaine Maxwell sought the counsel of Alan Dershowitz, who had represented Epstein, who told her that he believed the deal would maintain her freedom. Now, of course, the Southern District of New York, which is notoriously, they don't bring charges against individuals unless they believe they have a winnable case. And rarely do those cases ever go to court because their cases are so watertight. The SDNY didn't believe that the agreement that Acosta struck was valid. It challenged that very notion simply with Epstein's arrest. They argued that the deal only applied to the specific attorney's office in Florida that agreed to that agreement, not all 94 federal prosecutors' offices in the country. That was never litigated in a court of law. It's going to be if Ghislaine Maxwell decides to fight her charges. And on a separate note, that could open the floodgates to a number of cases that could be relitigated in other jurisdictions. So I don't think we have necessarily heard the last of that argument, but this has to raise questions around Ghislaine Maxwell. Why did she decide to remain in the United States if there was this active investigation into her. She was so confident that that prior deal would save her that she chose not to do what would have seemed the obvious for a criminal like her. Use your vast resources to escape justice. Board a private jet, flee to a country like France where the extradition process is notoriously arduous. Don't forget, Roman Polanski, the famous film director, delivered one of the great vanishing acts from justice after he pled guilty to statutory rape of a 13-year-old girl in 1977. He fled the United States, and despite the U.S.'s legal attempts to bring him back to face the courts, he's been residing in France ever since. Now, Ghislaine Maxwell had French citizenship. She had more than 15 bank accounts and $20 million to her name. She had the ability to evade justice. Instead, she buys a million-dollar property in Bradford, New Hampshire, 156 acres, and put simply, sits there in wait to be arrested. She was guilty.
Why?
She might not be guilty of six things that the federal government has accused her of, but here's what she was guilty of. Excessive hubris.
Right. Wow. She certainly was similar to Epstein in that regard.
Well, she believed she was untouchable because of the high
powered
figures and notable names that they had exploited. So,
and because, because the list of Clinton and all these high powered politicians and attorneys and Randy Andy, all these people.
Well, the case is not red or blue. This comes back to what I said before the break. It's not, it's an operation that ran for four decades. Many, many presidents have sat in the Oval Office of Democrat and Republican beliefs. People that have run intelligence groups in the United States have had affiliations with certain ideological lines. So the case of Epstein and Maxwell doesn't discriminate, which is why the media, whose core function is to be a bastion of truth and impartiality, is not interested in this story or the real story of Jeffrey Epstein because it doesn't fit within their mandate to push for profits. And they understand that they're going to get a captive audience if you're on the left for Trump-bashing content and if you're on the right for pro-Trump coverage.
Right.
That's a gross injustice to the American people because, though, as you can tell, I have a thick Brooklyn accent. Actually, I'm joking. It's Australian.
I didn't figure it was Brooklyn.
You know, I'm a citizen of the United States. I hold a green card. I want to know if the government allowed these two to operate with impunity on American soil, because someone who knows Jane Doe in the latest lawsuit, I am disgusted if what I believe to be true took place. And no amount of cover-up will stop me from pursuing the real story, the true untold story of the Epstein and Maxwell sex trafficking ring. Which is why I'm writing another book due out in September called Epstein and Maxwell, Inc., How the U.S. Government May Blackmail Big Business.
Wow. I'll be sure and purchase it the minute it comes out. Chapter 14, Dead or Gone, that whole situation with the guards and all of the situation where the person that was his cellmate was all of a sudden transferred out and the guards fell asleep and the camera didn't work and all these other situations. personally, I don't think he's dead.
There is a part of me that would love him not to be dead, and that some law enforcement investigation would uncover him and bring him to justice. I do believe that he is dead. Did he commit suicide? I believe he did.
Really?
I believe it was an aided and abetted suicide. I believe a message was got to him, and he was told that, you know, your expiration date has expired, and take your own life, or someone else will take it for you. The simple reality is, you don't try and attempt suicide, as he did 2 weeks prior to his eventual death, be returned into regular prison population so soon thereafter. I know inmates that have attempted suicide that have been locked in what's called the hole, solitary confinement, for months.
Right.
Instead, Epstein was let back into regular prison population, given clothing to wear, as opposed to paper, so that you cannot use the clothing to tie a noose around your neck and hang yourself. Nor are you given electrical appliances with cords that could be used to, again, hang yourself, or be given prescription pills to potentially overdose from. So my belief is it was an aided and abetted suicide, and that there was corruption running rampant inside the Metropolitan Correction Facility in Manhattan, and as a result of that, he was given the means, the opportunity, and he was told that there was a motive for him to kill himself.
Now, how would you compare the situation that Ghislaine Maxwell is in to Epstein's situation? Do you think that she would go this route? What do you think is, of course, you're not a prophet, but certainly you have a lot of intuition about this and a lot of background information about this. Do you see her?
Go ahead. Watched prisoner in the world. The U.S. government can ill afford for her to take her own life behind bars. But that in itself would effectively silence the sex trafficking operation and not give truth or ever reveal to the public actually what took place between Ghislaine and Jeffrey Epstein. She has three distinct options right now, none of which are a good result for her. She could attempt to strike a deal, a plea bargain, in which she would plead guilty to certain charges in exchange for concessions from the prosecution. Those concessions likely would include an agreement to seek a lower sentence, or likely to convict her of 4 of the 6 charges in the indictment, and they'd probably waive the perjury. Regardless, freedom for her would still be a long time coming, and she likely would see a sentence of 20 to 30 years. Secondly, she could choose to fight the indictment in court. Now, to most defense attorneys unconnected to this case, this would seem like a very foolish move, because, as I said earlier, the Southern District doesn't bring these cases unless they're unimpeachable. And facing 35 years in prison, almost certainly what's left of her life, she would get. Look at the cases of Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, and others, where the judge throws the book at them because our culture has changed drastically when it comes to sentencing. And what's more, the evidence against her seems to be so compelling and overwhelming that it proves not only she was a madam, but she was also an utterly depraved pedophile. So I can't see a court or a jury of her peers going easy on her. Now, the only other option available to her would be to turn whistleblower and lay out exactly how this blackmail and sex trafficking network operated and just who else was involved, including the many high-powered figures and notable names that we know that until now have avoided arrest. To do that, she would have to name names. I'm told she doesn't want to name names. There are some people she wants to protect and others she doesn't want to. But she's unlikely to have a choice. If you tell on one, you must tell on all. The SDNY will not let her cherry pick who she chooses to throw under the bus or protects. So I just don't see that as a viable option for her. And she also has to understand that going to court means theoretically that the case the Southern District has built against her will be laid out in implicit details. It's like building something from building blocks. They have used other witnesses to build the indictment by the grand jury with testimony that would suggest they have the unimpeachable case. But just what if, I want to throw this out there, I have zero evidence to back this up, but the biggest bombshell to come out of her last court appearance on July 15 was the revelation that she had a secret husband.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, she's not named that husband to pretrial services, which is an organization that prepares people for court appearances. She's not told the Department of Justice who that spouse is or given any indication how long she was married for.
Wow.
And all of this begs the question, who was she secretly married to and why?
Wow. Okay, we do have a 3-minute break. We'll be right back and then give us your theory. We'll be right back. And you had a theory. I just want to ask you one thing. Apparently, Ghislaine had a submarine and piloted children. Is that true, or is that just a rumor? Dylan?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, okay, now I can. Uh-huh. Did you hear my question?
Sorry, what was your question? I did
apparently,
not.
Apparently, Ghislaine Maxwell had a submarine. Is that true, that she piloted children?
I've not heard that. I know she had a helicopter license.
Wow.
But I'm not sure about the submarine. There has been a lot of allegations about submarines being used around the so-called Orgy Island. But there is no empirical evidence to suggest anything untoward there.
Wow.
So before the break, I had talked about what I thought was the biggest revelation from Ghislaine's appearance on July 15, and that was that she was secretly married to an unknown companion. And I have to preface this by saying I have no evidence to suggest this, but what I do know in having studied Maxwell and Epstein for a decade now is that these two were very Machiavellian. So just what if, and I place a significant emphasis on the word is, Maxwell's secret husband is none other than Jeffrey Epstein himself.
Oh.
Now, as conspiratorial as that might sound, such a union could be the ultimate and unforeseen get-out-of-jail-free card for Ghislaine Maxwell. Why? Because spousal privilege exists remarkably even after death.
Yes.
So while others have speculated, perhaps with more wisdom than me, that Maxwell's secret husband is simply there to protect her fortune, I am told through sources that Ghislaine had once joked that Jeffrey Epstein's legal troubles might force him to do what she had wanted to do forever, and that was marry him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jeffrey also loved legal loopholes. So
right.
Let's consider the notion that potentially she is married to Jeffrey Epstein. That would mean that that would explain why she was so confident in not leaving the United States.
Right.
And it would also explain how she would avoid self-incrimination before a jury of her peers. Much of the evidence that the government would have would be quashed. They would be relying on the credibility of other witnesses, and it would be simply a case of almost like O.J. Simpson and Casey Anthony. That
right.
trust and credibility of other witnesses is often fraught with danger when faced with a jury room. Now, Ghislaine Maxwell cannot self-incriminate herself, and she could throw out all evidence, including writings, receipts, text messages, handwritten notes, diaries, plain receipts, emails between her and Epstein.
Right. Adela, we've run out of time. Can you come back in September after your next book comes out?
Anytime.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you so much for your work and for your thoughts and being on the program today. Thank you very much.
My absolute
now.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
We'll be right back with our next guest.